So once again, welcome all to the January 18th Q&A session. If anybody's new with us, guests are always welcome. However, if you want to join, if you join before March 31st, bargain basement price of 2 years for the price of one, $20 will get you 2 years. And the link is in the chat, and you can find it on our website as well on how to join our group. And with that, I will turn it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck.
Okay, thanks, Chris, and welcome, everyone. We have a mixed bag again tonight, so we're going to get right to it. And I'm going to start with a couple of smartphone apps that Jeff Dubois has sent in. The first one he likes is called Compass Steel 3D, and it's basically a compass for your smartphone. Jeff uses it for fishing, I guess, so he doesn't get lost, or so he knows where to find the fish or something. It doesn't have ads, and it's basically just request donations. And if you pay 99 cents for a cup of coffee for the developer, then you get some extra capability. So if you're in need of a 3D compass, then there you go. And then the second one is an app that allows you to link your phone to Windows. If you have an Android phone, then the app is called Linked Windows. And what it does is it allows you to send and receive text messages on the PC and rather than on the phone. And if you have a pre-Windows 10 PC, then you need to use a slightly different app, which is called Pulse SMS. And it basically does the same thing. So if either of those apps appeals to you, the links are there. You can download them from the Play Store. Okay, the next thing we have is a question that came in when we asked for topics that people wanted to hear about. One of the questions that came in was, is storing files in the cloud a safe thing to do? And the first thing I'll just refer you to is Stéphane Richard's presentations on the basics of cloud storage, and where he covered a whole raft of what cloud storage is and how it works and some of the benefits and some of the limitations. So again, these are available as PDF files and part of the recordings too. From our previous Q&A sessions. So just to pull out a few things to answer the question from Stefan's presentation. The cloud storage is being provided by some kind of company. And typically, as part of that provision, they give you various layers of security. So for example, to access your account, your storage, typically, you need a user ID and a password, and many of the cloud storage services offer you two-factor authentication, which may or may not be optional. However, one of the things you should bear in mind is if you just upload files to the cloud, then it's no longer on your particular computer, or at least you may have a copy of it, but the information is now on the web, essentially. So it's probably not a good idea to have only the copy on the cloud. For one thing, providers come and go, unless you're one of the really big providers. Some of these guys actually go out of business. And because it's in the cloud, it's a web-based product, then the web server is always subject to being hacked. And you notice down the bottom there's a recent article from PC Magazine where LastPass, the password vault provider, was hacked, and the hacker stole the encrypted databases. So presumably he's going to try and break into those at his leisure. So my advice, you're going to use cloud storage, keep backups of the files that you store in the cloud, and don't include any sensitive data. And if you do, make sure that you use a strong encryption on the file before you upload it to the cloud. Okay, so...
Just before you go on that, I just happened across today, SANS put out their weekly SANS bulletin, and it turns out Norton LifeLock password manager was also compromised recently, not anywhere near to the numbers that the folks at LastPass had, but yeah, I was thinking about looking for a replacement password manager that would be stored in the cloud specifically so that would make it a little easier to share amongst my devices and access from anywhere. And it's making me rethink that. And one of the things that is kind of nice about KeePass is that while you can roll your own way of sharing it through your own cloud service and things like that, it's not designed to be done that way, so it doesn't present quite the target that people like LastPass and Norton LifeLock have. So just some cautions about password managers in particular being stored in the cloud.
And the neat thing about KeePass is that you can use the same database file on multiple platforms. So the same file will work on both Windows and Linux, for example. Okay, so moving along, we've got Chris is going to tell us some stuff about sharing Google Drive.
Yeah, this is really a follow-up to the presentation I gave on how to share a link to share a file on Google Drive. And I was a little bit confused about the way things came up, and I realized afterwards why. So when you are using Google Drive and you want to share a file, you can just go to the website, files, drive.google.com, and then if you're logged in under your account, you can go to any file that you see. You can right-click on it, and or I think it might be left-click, and then you get an option there to actually share through Google Drive and get a link. Next.
Oh,
and then Linda pointed out that this created a link that only gave permission to people that you specifically gave access to rather than any sort of global permissions. Next. I was sort of puzzled by that because when I use GetLink, anyone with the link can access the file. But when I demoed it, I think this was last week or the week before, I guess it was the week before, we didn't have Q&A last week, it was not the case. It ended up that it was only shared to people that I specifically gave permission to. So I thought, what the fudge? So next. So it turns out that the default permissions in actual fact are specific people, and none is in there. You have to add people to that. And then general access is set to restricted. Only people who have access can open the link. And by default, there's nobody in that. So by default, absolutely nobody will have permission to actually access that file. Next. So if you click on either the share or get link, it actually opens the same dialog box. Next. The only difference between it is where the focus is. So if you start typing or hit enter or whatever, what's going to happen? So if you clicked on share, it actually brings you to that box where you can actually put in a Google account for somebody that you want to be able to access these files or this file. And by default, I mean, all Gmail accounts are Google accounts. So if you know somebody's on Gmail, you could add in their Gmail address, and that would give them permission. Otherwise, it's possible to make any email address into a Google account. It's just a little bit of an extra step that people have to go through to do that. If you clicked on Get Link instead, it automatically changes the focus over to the little box that says Get Link. And if you actually hit enter, it would just copy the link for that file to your clipboard. But notice that the access is still restricted. Okay, so by default, you haven't given access to anybody. Next. So an easier way and far more secure way, as far as I'm concerned, and why I was confused, is because this is what I recommend that people actually do. Create a top-level folder in your Google Drive, name it public, and then only put files there that you want to share with other people that are not private information, even private between just a couple of people. Have it that you put into public anything. You don't care if anybody who happens to get access to this is able to see it. And this is what I've done. Next. Then what you do, okay, before that, this helps avoid accidentally sharing files, because if you put a file into a folder called public, it triggers it in the mind that, okay, this is something that's going out publicly now. Do I really want to put this here? Next. The other thing that it can do is help avoid a mess, because if you don't do this and you start sharing individual files all over the place, you can lose track of what files you've actually shared with other people. If you put them all under public, just basically assume that everything that goes in under there is going to be accessible by anybody who gets a hold of the link. Next. So what you do is you then go and you set the permissions on that public folder. So you go in the root of your Google Drive, you select the public folder, and then you go in and you want to share this. And so you go with anyone who has the link and set it to viewer. So the default permission is restricted. So you change this so that anybody with access to any link below public is going to be able to view that particular file. Next. And then if you look, here's an example. So I took a file, whostheboss.pdf. I put it within my public folder. And then by default, anyone with that link was able to view that file. I think that's a much, much better way of sharing information, because you don't have to worry about where are my shared files and things like that. And my final slide, there is, next, if you go to the default role, you can actually go in and you can change it from something other than viewer. So you can make it viewer, commenter, editor. I don't do anything on my Google Drive, anything other than viewer. I don't particularly want to allow people to edit files. I don't want them to comment on my files. I don't know what that would even look like. I really suggest that you just set it to viewer. If somebody wants to be able to edit it, have them download the file themselves, edit it, and then get it back to you some way. But those are options if you wanted to go in and make the link, the person can actually edit the file in place or whatever. And that's it for my advice now on using Google Drive.
Okay, there's a question for you from Natalie. She says, the other quirk is that Google Drive access can only be people with a Gmail account.
Yep.
Unless there's a workaround if I miss.
No. If you set it up so that it's restricted access, you can do it like I say, where you say general access and you say anyone with the link can view it. But if you only want specific people to be able to even view it, so you're using that top box that you see in there where it says add people or groups, that has to be a Google account. And the reason is, if Google has to say, I'm restricting this to specific people, what are their options? The only thing that they can authenticate against is a Google account. Now, Gmail, as I said, Gmail is a Google account, and any other email address can be made into a Google account fairly easily. You just go to accounts.google.com and you say you want a new one. You use another third-party email address and you say, I want to make this a Google account. You'll have to give a password for it. I don't suggest that you use the same password as your actual email account. It really is a separate entity. It looks like an email address, but it's really just a token. It's a name of a Google account. So you can make any other address a Google account and do that. I suggest that for the most part, unless it's something that is really sensitive, just have it, anyone with the link can do it. What's the chance that somebody who is just going to happen across that link? Probably not great. But if you do want to restrict it to only specific people, it's not a Gmail account, it's a Google account. So that would be a requirement.
And there was a comment from Jeff. He basically notes that Microsoft stopped support for OneDrive Personal for Windows 8.1 users last summer. But if you run FileZilla Pro, which is a registered version of the open source product, you can sync via FTP to several different cloud storage services like Google Drive or OneDrive, and that gives you a workaround for the lack of support on OneDrive. Okay, thanks, Chris. I don't see anything else in the chat, so
okay.
I'm going to move along to talk briefly about Dropbox. And this basically comes about because of the item where Chris was showing how to create a link to a file. And to me, it sounded very complicated. And I'm still not clear that, you know, it still seems hard to me to use Google Drive. I've actually been using Dropbox for quite a few years. I use Dropbox Basic, which is the free version. By default, you get 2 gigabytes of storage. And that's fine for me because I only use Dropbox to share files with other people on a kind of a temporary basis. So it's really a transfer mechanism as far as I'm concerned. Dropbox does require a user ID and a password, and I have separate user IDs and passwords for that account. And it has optional two-factor authentication, which personally I don't use, but I'm not terribly concerned about the material that I do store in the cloud. The good news is it supports multiple devices, so computers, smartphones, tablets, and also multiple platforms. So for me, Windows and Android, and Linux too, actually, come to that, is useful. There's both a desktop and a mobile app, or you can use web-based access. And it allows you to synchronize files, and more importantly for me, it allows the sharing of files and folders. So basically, it's really easy, I think, in Dropbox. So here's my Dropbox account. Here's a couple of files. I select the file which I'm interested in, and by default, it pops up this menu here where I can just hit copy link, and it creates a string. And if I send that link to anybody over email, then they can access that file. So it's really simple to share a file. But like Chris said, you can also create folders. So I could create a folder, and I can create a shared folder. So let's create a folder called OPCUG Share. I'm going to restrict it to specific people. And in fact, it's only going to be Chris and I that are sharing this folder. So I send Chris an email. I allow him to edit so he can add files, delete files, edit files, as opposed to only being able to view them, which is like a read-only access. So I give Chris full access to this folder and all the files inside it. And then when we go and look at that folder, then you will see that both myself and Chris are the members who are sharing this folder. And here are the various files that we're sharing. And lo and behold, it's things like Q&A and the PowerPoint deck. And the deck that Chris just showed, the slides on the Google Drive links. So that's the way that we basically create these PowerPoint decks for Q&A by we use Dropbox to share the files. Okay, that's all we have, I think, on cloud storage sharing. Harvey, if you want to unmute your microphone, and Harvey's got an item here on synchronizing calendar and contacts.
All right, thank you very much, Alan. I'm going to go over this, I call it a technique that you can use with regards to the Microsoft Outlook desktop, usage of your smartphone, and we're going to look at an Outlook add-in that's from Fieldson Software. Now, as you're aware, Microsoft Outlook, you can create your email account, so typically people will create an IMAP account. Now, in there, you will see folders for calendar and contacts, but they also have this item that says, this computer only, which means it's only local to that IMAP. It does not allow you to do any sync on it. Also, if you expect to get meeting requests coming into your account, IMAP just does not process those. There's no link to a calendar. What you can do, though, is in the IMAP setup, you can create an Outlook PST file that will help you overcome that problem. So in any event, the calendar and contacts in the IMAP there's very limited sharing capabilities. Now, in the POP3, the older method of setting up your accounts, the calendar and contacts in there can be shared. There is a way of doing it. But we'll move on. For example, in your smartphone, with whether it's Android or iOS, what you're typically doing is manually entering in, let's say, a calendar item or a contact, that type of thing. So we're going to look at a method on how to do that using this add-in called G-Syncit from Fieldston Software. That'll allow us to set up the configuration for syncing calendar and contacts between the Outlook desktop and Google. So next slide, please. All right, so we'll just look at the setup procedure. I'm hoping I don't confuse you. But anyway, let's just say we're going to be creating an Outlook PST file, or you are already using that type of file. It's already there. You can put your calendar and contacts into that PST file. We're also going to utilize a Google account, so you may already have one. What you can do is you can export your calendar and contacts from the PST file and then bring them into your Google account. Now, those URLs there are where you would go to physically just look at what's in your calendar on the Google side of things and what's in your contacts. Now, what we'll be doing is we're going to install G-Sync, the Outlook add-in, and then we're going to set up how that's going to interact with Google. Next slide, please. All right, so G-Sync, it's at version 5, and as it says there, sync Microsoft Outlook with your mobile or cable device. You'll notice that the lower portion, there are several types of services that this G-Sync will support. Now, the main one that we're looking at tonight is the Google service. But as you can see, there's several others, including this thing called iCloud. But if you looked up some of those types of services, it'd be quite interesting that, you know, you may be able to utilize them. Next slide, please. Now, this is the settings that we see when we're in the Outlook program. We can then open up G-Sync, and what I'm focusing on is where it says in the left margin, Google Sync. Now, it will sync calendar and contact, but it also can do the remaining tasks also, so task sync or notes. Towards the center of the slide, the calendar sync configuration, we set it up, tell it what we want to do there, and of course it's going to show you in the middle what Google Calendar are you working with and what mapping description we're giving it, so Outlook to Google. However, it's a two-way type of environment. It's going to be Outlook to Google and Google back to Outlook. Similarly, with contacts below, we can set that up and tell it where the contacts are. Next slide, please. All right, now, this is a bit of a map on how this all fits together. So let's just have a look at each one of these. Your Microsoft Outlook does use a calendar and contacts within the PST file. So if you're sitting at your desktop, you can look at a calendar that will be your Microsoft calendar. You can look at your contacts. That will be your Microsoft contact. On your smartphone, you will also have the ability to identify, you know, a calendar and contacts within Google. You can map it to look at that. Now, when you're doing the so-called syncing, it's going to match the entries, so to speak, and it will avoid anything duplicate. You won't have that issue. Now below, if we look on the left column titled Outlook, what I'm showing you there is I have an IMAP account and it's connecting into web name server. That's the offline storage, OST, and that focuses mainly on email. The subset under that, PST, is a file that we can set up strictly to handle only calendar and contact data. All right. In the middle of the slide, titled Smartphone, we'll get back to that in a second. Under the Google item there, Google, we're focusing on the Google calendar and the Google contacts data. Now, when we put it all together to sync, you're going to see in the middle, your smartphone is going to be able to access the IMAP email. Your smartphone is going to be able to access the arrow going toward Google to look up calendar and contacts. Now, these things are going to be changed or updated on your smartphone or while you're in your desktop Outlook. So you can make changes to either one of those elements. Down below where we see the GSyncIt box, this is where GSyncIt will kick in. If you make a change on your Outlook desktop, it will immediately sync that change or changes over to the Google files. Similarly, if your smartphone is making changes to the Google files, it too will be synced back to the Outlook information on your desktop. So everything is staying in sync. Not to, isn't that a rock group, the in sync? Anyway. Next slide, please. Now, if I'm looking at my smartphone and I'm using or accessing the Google side of things, this is the Microsoft Outlook app. So when I go into calendar, for example, January, I see my meetings on my smartphone. Now, if I was to go to, let's say, the Google calendar and look that up, it would be identical. Similarly with contacts on my smartphone. That's what I see when I go in there. And you'll notice a line, you can just barely read it there. It's showing my Gmail account address and it's showing how many contacts I have in there. So again, that type of information, I'm looking at the Google side of things. It does not look at the Outlook side of things. Next slide, please.
And that's it.
All right. All right. I hope I hope I described this well enough that this is something that might be useful in your everyday life. Thank you.
Yeah, I think for anybody who's using Outlook and a smartphone, it looks like a really neat solution. Yeah, so thanks very much for that, Harvey.
All righty. Thank you.
And next up, we have a question that came in, which Chris will talk about.
Yeah, so this came in from Carol Pearson, and she wanted to know what was safe in Disk Cleanup. So if you run Disk Cleanup, it will come up with a list of things that you can have it remove. And she wondered, is what's safe to remove and what's not safe to remove. And because she wasn't sure, she usually chose just to empty the recycle bin and remove temporary internet files. But she wanted to know, is there more that it can be done? So next. So if you want to maximize the options, the first thing to know is that as soon as Disk Cleanup loads, click on the Cleanup System Files button and Disk Cleanup will close and it will reopen and it will take a little bit longer to reopen because it examines more areas. So next. So in my case, when I ran this to get the screenshots, it went from next. It reloaded and then it came up and it went from 9 categories to 13 categories. So there were additional categories that pop up if you tell it to clean system files as well. Now, one of the biggest ones in there is Windows Update Cleanup. And this will vary from being virtually nothing to potentially gigabytes worth of information in Windows Update Cleanup. And you will only get that if you click on that button to say clean up system files. So next.
I'm just wondering, are some of these folders the same, and do they always show the same number of bytes to be cleared up? The temporary internet files, is there 8 or 1 kilobytes on both?
Yeah, I think if they appear in both, I think they should be identical, because I didn't think that they were cleaning up anything different. It's just that you get additional categories that will show up if you click on the use cleanup system files. So what you can do is you can click on any item, and you will get a description in the bottom box that tells you a little bit more about what it is that you're actually going to be cleaning up. And I usually just don't bother with anything under about 100 megabytes. To me, who cares? You know, 100 megabytes, then, you know, might vary as to what you figure is inconsequential. But you can see a few things on the list there, like 12 kilobytes. Is it worth worrying about Windows Upgrade log file if it's using 12 kilobytes? Especially if I'm uncertain about whether to delete it or not. Well, it's not using up any significant space anyway, so just don't worry about it. So if you see things that are big, you know, for me, it's usually around the 100 megabytes is when I really start to get concerned that, hey, this is worth cleaning up. So if you don't understand it, either don't select it and just accept the fact that some waste space may be, you know, headed your way, or Google about that particular option until you find out more and when you're sure of whether you actually do want to delete it or not. So next.
The thing I find sometimes, Chris, is it, you tell it to delete it, but it doesn't delete the whole thing. There's always some files left.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things you will run into in that for sure, almost certainly, is temporary files. Temporary files, they may be actually in use by an application at the time, so they can't be deleted, or things like that. So there is potential, but usually it will clean out the vast majority of what's there if it doesn't catch absolutely everything. So here are my recommendations. So these are some of the ones that I figure you should consider as either safe or not safe. So Windows Update Cleanup, to me, it's safe to delete as long as you're not having any problems with your computer a couple of days after Patch Tuesday, the second Tuesday of the month where the patches come out. As soon as the patches get applied to your computer, do a countdown of a couple of days. If a couple of days later, your computer's still working fine, what's the likelihood that you're going to want to roll back those updates that came in on Patch Tuesday? Probably pretty low. So I sort of figure after a couple of days, you know, that's why those files are left around, is so that you can actually roll back those changes. If you have some hardware device all of a sudden stops working, well, you can roll back that monthly update, and hopefully it'll replace it with the good file that didn't have a problem. So I figured that's safe, and it can be huge amounts of files in the Windows Update Cleanup. Again, only if your computer is running smoothly a couple of days after you apply the monthly updates. Microsoft Defender Antivirus, that's completely safe to delete. It's just the previous version of the program or the signature files, and you'll absolutely never need that at all. If you have a problem with Windows Defender, it can actually just install itself again to get you back to a working state. Windows Upgrade log files, I say they're not likely needed, but they're usually pretty small. But as I noted in the red box, I say biggest bang for the buck, and I put Windows Upgrade log files. And I just noticed today that I had this in both locations, and obviously one of them is in error. I'm not sure whether they are typically large or typically small. But Windows Upgrade log files, typically you're not going to ever need those. But if they're not big, who cares? Downloaded program files are always safe to delete. They are not the things that, you know, you went and downloaded a program from the internet. It is stuff that automatically got downloaded, ready for install, and those are always safe to delete. They'll always be reinstallable through the normal means. Temporary internet files, I think, are always safe to delete. It's just cached locally. If you go back to that website, it'll just have to re-download that particular file. So it's not a big deal. Windows error reports and feedback data, I always delete those. If you do use that reporting function when something crashes and it says you want to report this to Microsoft or anything like that, they can be sizable files after a while. And so those are always safe to delete. I've never had Microsoft come back to me and say, oh, we didn't get that quite right. You want to resend it to us. DirectX shader cache, I don't know what it is, but it's a cache. So presumably it can repopulate itself if it has to. Delivery optimization files, I think they're safe to delete as well. Again, they're probably not going to be very big, those, but if anything, it will just speed up something that is going to happen by itself anyways. So I wouldn't worry about whether you have to delete that or not. Device driver packages, I say safe to delete if your computer is stable. So that does remove the ability, if you go into Device Manager and you go to a particular device and you say you want to roll back to a previous version of a device driver, that will remove the capability of doing that. But if your computer is stable, why would you ever want to roll back to an older version of the driver? Probably not a big deal. Language resource files, I think those are completely safe to remove. Recycle bin, all depends. Do you use your recycle bin in order to be able to recover stuff or not? If you don't use it to be able to recover files, then why not have it empty the recycle bin? However, if you do use your recycle bin of something that, oh, I deleted something last week and you go there to get it back, then you probably don't want to choose that. Temporary files, that depends, but generally speaking, it's safe to remove. And again, that'll only be temporary files that are not currently in use by some program. But think of a scenario, you might have some program crash, you reboot your computer, and it'll say, oh, we've got this temporary file that we can actually recover your data or something like that. So potentially there might be some information in there that might be useful at some point in time. Personally, I don't think it has ever applied to me, so I always just tell it, go ahead, delete temporary files. Thumbnails are always safe to remove. They are just the icons of thumbnails of pictures or icons or whatever, and if it has to display them again, it'll just rebuild it at that point in time. User file history is one where I say a bit of caution. If you use file history, and they actually tell you this in the description for it, that it may lose some file history that is actually going on at any point in time. There's some information that may be cached that hasn't been written to disk as a permanent entity. And so I would recommend that if you use file history, don't check that particular box. But other than that, yeah, all of the ones that I list there, I think, you know, whether they're safe or depends, and you have to think about whether that it makes sense for your particular computing environment. And that's all I have on disk cleanup.
Okay, thanks, Chris. And just to reinforce the point, if you're at all short on disk space, definitely run the system cleanup. Because as Chris mentioned, that Windows update cleanup, if you get a feature update, you'll probably find multi-gigabytes of files sitting on your drive, basically doing nothing. So that's a really good spot to get a whole bunch of. Oh, somebody just put a comment here. Recently upgraded the machine from 8.1 to 10. Did a system cleanup a few days later. 27 gigabytes of data in previous versions. So
now the majority of that would have gone automatically. When you do an upgrade to a new version of Windows, they allow you to roll back to the previous version. But you only have, I think it's 10 days or a week to do that. And if you don't roll back within that 10 days or a week, it'll automatically remove all of those files that give you the ability to do that rollback. And the majority of that 27 gigabytes would have been gone in a week or 10 days or something like that. But, yeah, it can certainly do a substantial cleanup on your system.
Okay. Thanks for that, Chris. That's very useful information. Okay, so our next item is Stefan Richard, who's got some information for us on computer number bases. So Stefan will be sharing his screen and unmuting his microphone, and then we'll be all ready to go. We hope. There he is.
Unmute.
No, he's not muted.
Oh.
We may not have sound.
Stefan had problems with his mic before, but then he did manage to get it fixed. So.
Yeah. Can you hear me now?
There we go. Yep.
Yeah. So, strangely enough, I didn't change the microphone, but on the setting for Zoom, you have a choice between same as system and the microphone from my headset. If I select the headset, it doesn't work. If I select same as system, it works. Anyway, mystery. Okay, so I will switch to my screen. Okay, do you see my title slide?
Yep.
Yes, we do.
Okay. So I will start by explaining the common number base are used in computing. But first, what is a number base? It's basically the number of digit or combination of digit that a system of counting use to represent number. So the definition may look complex, but if you look at an example, if you look at base 10, that's the base that human being use daily. So we use all these numbers from 0, 1, 2, 3, all the way to 9. And there is, since it's base 10, there is 10 symbol if you want. However, computer, internal, inside the computer, they don't use the base 10 to do any arithmetic or something like a function like that. They use base 2, binary. And in binary, there is only two symbols, 0 and 1. You may see also base 8, and this one is called octal, and there is 8 symbols, so it goes from 0, 1, 2, all the way to 7. The one that is used the most in computing that you most likely to see is base 16. It's called hexadecimal, and for this one, we need, since it's base 16, we need 16 symbols, so go 0, 1, 2, 3, and when we get to 9, they needed a new symbol, so they use the letter A, after that B, C, D, E, and F. And when you read an hexadecimal number, most of the time you will put either a dollar sign in front of the number to tell you that it's not a decimal number, but an hexadecimal number that you're seeing, or 0x, again, to show that it's base 16. And sometimes we need to convert from various base, like from basic hexadecimal to decimal or hexadecimal to binary. So I will show you how you can do that. But before we do that, let's count to 17 using different number base. So everyone, when they went to school, they learned the base 10, so we count 0, 1, 2. When we get to 9, we start using the same symbol at the beginning, and we add 1 to the left, and we keep counting 10, 11, 12, all the way to 17. Binary, it's a bit more tricky because there's only two symbols. So 0, it's easy, it's all zeros. If you do plus 1, it's easy again, you get 0, 0, 0, 1. But if you add 1, since you have only have two symbols, this one becomes a 0, and the next digit over become 1. So 2 expressed in binary is 1, 0, basically. Now, if you add 1 to that, you get 0 plus 1, it's 1, but and 1, so that's 3. When you get to 4, now it's more complicated because you need to carry over the carry. So if you add plus 1, this becomes a 0, but it's a 1 that is carry over. 1 plus 1, again, give you a 0, plus 1 plus 0 give you 1. So 4 is basically 1, 0, 0. So you will need a whole lot more digit to express any number in binary that if you do in base 10. Like if you look at the number 10, you need 4 binary digit, 1, 0, 1, 0, to express 10. Now, if we look at octal, base 8, so it's the same thing. When you get to 7, you don't go to 8, you go to 10. So basically 10 in octal is basically equate to 8 decimal. And when you keep counting, so you get to 11, 12, 13, 14, all the way to 17. Again, the bigger symbol you can get on octal is 7. So now you need to add, you go back and start again with 0 and you add 1. So the 1 become 2. So you get, so at 17, you switch over to 20 and you keep counting like this. In hexadecimal, this one has 16 symbols. So when you count, well, you do plus 1, it goes to 1, 2, 3. And when you reach 9, instead of giving you 10, you need to use a symbol A, after that B, C, D, E, and F. And when you get that F, if you need to add 1 to it, you get your 10 again. So it's basically starting over with that symbol there, and you add 1 to the multiple F as we did in context. So here you see there's the number 10 appear many times. It appear here in the hexadecimal. It appear here in octal. It appear here in binary. And they all mean different things. Like the 1-0 binary mean 2 in decimal. The 1-0 in octal mean 8. And the 1-0 in hexadecimal mean 16. And when you are doing coding or even like, and if you recall my previous presentation on TCP/IP, the IPv6 addressers are using hexadecimal numbers. So that's why it become useful to know what hexadecimal means basically. Another thing that is really useful, if you have a number expressed in binary, you can easily tell if it's an even or odd number. If the most right bit is 0, then it's even. So if we look at, let's pick this one here, it's finishing with a 0. It means like 100, it's 4, and 4 is even. If it's finishing with a 1, it's odd. So that's an easy way that in binary you can figure out very quickly just by doing a test. Is the last bit a 0 or 1? And you can figure out if it's odd or even. Now, like I said earlier, you can convert, if you want, a decimal value into any different base and vice versa. So we'll start with taking an example of a base 10 number, how do we express that, and how do we make that calculation. After that, we'll do an example with base 2. So let's look at the number 257 expressed in decimal. The first thing that we need to do is to label the position of the digit. So this digit is in position 0, this one is in position 1, this one is in position 2, and you keep adding if you have more digit. And after that, we need to determine what I call the digit weight. And it's basically the first digit, the one at position 0, the weight is always 1. And to get the weight of the next one to the left, you need to multiply it by the base. Here we use a base 10, so the next weight after that is 100. After that, the next one over will be 100. And after that, if you have more, 1,000, 10,000, you keep going like this. So, and the digit weight is basically the base to the power of the digit position. So now if you want to reconstruct that number, is the 7 is basically 10 to the power of 0, which is 1. So basically that weight here. So 7 times 1 give us a 7. If we take the other digit, so this one is in position 1. So it's 10 to the power of 1, which is basically 10 of that weight here. So you do 5 times 10 give you 50. And the 2, you go 10 to the power of 2, basically square, give it 100 of that weight here. You multiply it by 2, and you get 200. If you add all of these numbers, you get 257. And for the math people on the call, this is the generic formula that you can use. But not let's use a base different than 10. Let's use base 2. So let's say that I have this string of binary number that I want to convert to decimal. So the first thing I need to do is to figure out what are the weight of all of these digits. So the first one is always 1. And after that, since I'm using base 2, I just multiply by 2. So 2, 4, 8, 16, 32. And if I add more digit on the binary number I'm trying to translate, that will keep multiplying by 2. And after that, I just multiply the value that I have with the weight. So in that case, it would be 1 times 32 plus 1 times 16. This 10 times 80 plus 1 times 4 plus 1 times 2 plus 0 times 1. And if you do that calculation, you end up with 54. So this is how you can translate a binary number into base 10. Now we'll look at more details into the hexadecimal base. So you recall that table, basically, not that table, when I covered hexadecimal, there is, it goes from the digit 0, 1, all the way down to the letters A, B, C, D, E, and F. Their associated decimal value, up to 9, they are the same, but at A is equal to 10, B, 12, B, 11, C, 12, D, 13, and F, 15. And it's always useful to remember also what is their binary value, and I will explain why in a few minutes. So if you take that number 0, it's basically 4 zeros, that's easy. 1, it's 0, 1, 2, 3, and when you get to like 8, it's 1, 0, 0, 0. And if you use the formula that I show on the previous slide, you can figure out that 100 is basically 8. 9 would be 1001, and all the way down to when you get F, 15 decimal, in binary it's 111141. Now we'll take some example here of hexadecimal number that we want to convert to decimal, and after that we want to convert them to binary. So that's probably the easiest number. Let's say they have the hexadecimal number 00, and you want to convert it in binary. So the weight of that 0, since it's in second position, would be 16 times 0. So that 0 is this 0 here, plus this 0 here, give you 0, and binary would be 00. What I will show later on when I have more example on the screen, it's not that easy most of the time to get from the decimal value to binary, but it's really easy, very easy, especially if you recall that table, to go from the hexadecimal value to binary. Let's take another example, 10, so it's 16, so times 1, so that one is the one here, times the, because of that position of digit in the second number, the second digit if you want, so the weight is 16, plus 0 give you 16. And now to convert in binary, what I can do is I can look at that hexadecimal and go and look it up what 1 is. So 1 is 0001, so 0001. And 0, it's 40000. So it's very easy to go from the hexadecimal to just look up in the table what these things are and just list them like this. This one is, if you add 1 to it, you get 11 hexadecimal. So the previous one was 16, so we should expect to get 17. So it's not a big surprise. So it's 1 times 16 plus 1 gives you 17. And again, the binary, it's 1, 1, so it's this string twice, 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, 1. Now this one is a bit more challenging, so I want to the number EC hexadecimal. So the first thing I need to figure out is what is the value of E. So E, the decimal value is 14, and the E is in second position, so the weight is 16. So it's 16 times 14. And I need to go get the value of C. C is 12. So it's 16 times 14 plus 12 gave us 236. I can tell you that I will not be able to tell you right away from 200, what is the binary representation of 236. But to go from this to this, it's relatively easy because E is 1110, so 1110, and C, 1100, so 1100. So it's relatively easy to go from the hexadecimal to binary. This is the biggest number you can express with 2 digits in hexadecimal, so FF. So the value of that in decimal would be 16 times the value of S, it's 15, plus F again, so another 15. So if you do that calculation, you get 255, and binary will be 81, basically. This one has one more digit, so the weight of this one is going to be 1, the one of this weight is going to be 16, and this one is going to be 16 times 16, so 256. So to decode that, what I need to do is to D is 13, so it's 256 times 13 plus F is 15, so 16 times 15, and 3 is 3. So if I add, multiply these numbers, add them up, I get 3,571. Again, if you ask me to translate that into binary, it will probably take a while. But if I know what the hexadecimal value is, it's relatively easy. You go get the D, which is 1101, so 1101. The F is 41111, and the 3 is 00111. Now, if we want to do the reverse, I have a decimal number and I want to express it in hexadecimal or any other base, I will use, you know, on that slide, the hexadecimal, but if it's the same calculation, you use a different, depending on the base you want to convert to. So the first thing you do, you divide the decimal number by 16. So in that case, hexadecimal is the base. If you wanted to translate it in binary, you divide it by 2. But you need to treat the remainder of the division as an integer division. So you'll get a remainder, and you need to express that remainder as an hexadecimal number. So, and you repeat step, and you need to write down the value of that remainder. And you repeat that division again and again until you get a result of 0. And when you get a result of 0, you have basically converted your decimal number into an hexadecimal. So we'll do an example. Oh, sorry. And to get hexadecimal value, you need to read back this remainder from the last one you've done to the first one. So you need to read it in reverse order that you. So let's say I want to convert the number 540 decimal into hexadecimal. So I will do the first division. So I will divide 540 by 16. I'm getting 33 point something. So the 33 and the remainder, I need to express it. The remainder was 12 decimal, but 12 is the letter C in hexadecimal. So I need to write down, remember that C. After that, I divide what the 33 by 16 again, so I get 2 and something. The remainder is 1, so by that's the next remainder I need to remember. And after that, I divide the 2 by 16, I get 0 and a remainder of 2. So the hexadecimal, if I read the remainder from last to first, so basically it's 2, 1, C. So basically, 540 decimal is basically 21C in hexadecimal. And I put the 0x to indicate that it's an hexadecimal number. Or if you want, instead of doing all of this calculation manually, you can just use the window calculator. The window calculator is very powerful. Probably most people only use the basic calculator. But if you click on the hamburger menu here, you will get a menu of all kinds of different calculators you can get. And one of them is called the programmer calculator. So if you select that, click on it, and the calculator will change format if you want. So here, you're going to select, you have a choice between hexadecimal, decimal, octal, and binary. And you can select the small blue bar here is telling the calculator, the number you're going to type here, what number is going to be. And automatically, as you type numbers, it will update these values as you type. And when you change, if you click on one of these different input, if you want, if you click on X, that keypad here is going to change, and the letters A, B, C are going to appear. So you can select them and type a number. So I selected the decimal, and I type 540. And it's telling me that it's basically hexadecimal 21C. If I wanted the value in octal, it's here. And in binary, you get exactly the same binary value that we calculated earlier. And that's it for me. Any questions?
I didn't see anything in the chat.
Yeah, nothing in the chat.
Okay.
Okay, so thanks very much. I think now we know why we need a computer, or at least we know why we need a Windows calculator. Okay, so, Chris has got one thing here.
Yeah, just a real quick one. We're basically out of time, but this one I can cover off quite quickly. Orion is on the call tonight. He sent in a message asking, should he update to Windows 10 22H2, which is actually the latest feature update to Windows 10. And he's currently running Windows 10 version 21H2, which is a year previous that it came out. He says he could download it, and he read about problems there are with 22H2. So he wanted to know what are the benefits of the new version, and should he delay until more bugs have been solved. So I did a little bit of reading about it. And I came across this article that is posted at the Microsoft blog website. And this is fairly recent. It was dated January 10th of this year. And they list resolved issues with 22H2. And they actually list seven issues that they have resolved. Now, they don't list any unresolved issues, so who knows, maybe there are some that they haven't resolved yet, but the URL is there, and I will also paste this into the chat window if anybody wants to read up on those. So I guess what I would say to Orion is, have you seen any reports of problems that are not on the resolved list, and are they important to you? So next. I did some other research on it, and I came across this at Windows Central that said it's a very minor release, focused mostly on under-the-hood improvements that are mostly aimed at the enterprise customer. So in all likelihood, it's not going to be a big deal. So it was released on October 18th, so it's been, what, 3 months? October, November, December, January, yeah, about 3 months that it's been out there. And currently they're only listing seven bugs that were known issues that they have fixed. Again, there could be additional ones, but I think that in all likelihood, most significant bugs would have been fixed by now. Next. So there are other overriding issues, I think. So there's end-of-life issues. When Microsoft comes out with a feature release, they are now saying they will support it for 2 years, and that's it. So the end of life for 21H2, they actually listed on their website as being end of life June 13th of 2023. So you've only got a couple more months to go before they are no longer going to release fixes for that. And if there's any problems with it, they will just say, well, upgrade to 22H2 or whatever happens to be the most current at that point in time. And the URL is there and in the chat as well, where you can look up all of the lifecycle information. Bottom line, I don't think there's a lot of benefits to 22H2. On the other hand, you really should update before June 13th just so that you're in a supported mode. And that's it for it.
Thanks, Chris. Tom put a comment in that he updated in January and found some cookies and shortcuts had been deleted.
Yeah, I read something recently that some were finding that, and it seemed to be related mostly to people, and I don't think it was directly related to 22H2, but there's some talk about it causing problems, and it seemed to be related to those that are on Windows Defender, their enterprise version of it that is managed by the enterprise that was actually causing some problems on that. But it didn't seem to affect the consumer end of that product. So, yeah, I get you, Tom, that you say you're not on enterprise. That's the only thing that I have read recently, not to say that, it doesn't bleed over somehow into other things. That's all that Microsoft was admitting to at this point in time.
Okay, so thanks, everyone, for the speakers. We usually leave a few minutes at the end and for questions, but we're basically over our allotted hour. I did ask if there are any questions in the chat window, and nobody entered anything, so I don't feel too badly that we didn't leave you with any time. So if you do have questions, we'll be here next week. So a couple of things to finish up with. As Chris mentioned early on, we have our 2-for-1 special again this year. If you join the club before March the 31st, then your membership fee of $20 actually gets you 2 years membership for the price of one. And the existing members, you don't have to renew because the board is giving you an additional year on your membership expiry at no additional cost. So a deal for new members and a deal for current members. As I said, next week we'll be here, January the 25th. So if you have any questions or if you have any things that you would like to share, like Harvey and Stefan did tonight, please feel free to contact us as usual. And hopefully we'll see you all next week. Good night, everyone.
Good night, folks. Thanks for showing up.